Right, I think let's start there. So, welcome everybody this Thursday, October morning. For those of you that don't know us, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with MPM Legal. We're a specialist employment and business immigration practice based in the south of England, but we support businesses that are all over the world and they have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK. I am delighted to be joined this morning by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Morning.
And also delighted to welcome you to the first episode in our series three now of Employment Law 101. So delighted to be getting into a third series of this. We are going to be looking this series at a topic which I think is at the forefront of a lot of people's minds, both employers and employees, and that is the current cost of living crisis and economic uncertainty and how that is impacting on HR and the employment relationship. And in today's session, we're looking at the cost of living crisis specifically and just setting the scene really for some of the future webinars that we've got coming up, as well as talking about some of the practical things that we've seen other businesses doing to help employees at the moment. Before we get into that, just a couple of housekeeping points. For those of you that have joined us before, you will be familiar with the fact that we record these sessions. We put a recording up onto our website next week, probably. It will go live. And we also have the audio recording available on Spotify and I believe Apple Music as well. Wherever you listen to your podcast, you can come back, re-listen to the audio from today, and of course, share it. Very much encourage participation. If you've got any comments to make, please use the chat function down at the bottom of your screen. You should be able to access that. Also, if you have any specific questions you'd like us to address today during the webinar, do use the Q&A function. So if you've got questions you'd like us to answer, use the Q&A. Any other observations, then please use the chat function as well. We've got a couple of polls to run today as well. So just be interesting to get a bit of feedback from you. But let me hand over to Adrienne. We're just going to look at some of the statistics that have come out of the past 12 months. Adrienne.
Yeah, there's some quite frightening statistics on this cost of living crisis, and I'll just run through some of them. So, I mean, obviously, we all know about the headlines about the rate of inflation, which peaked, I think it was around about 11% last October, so 2022, which is still running at around 6%, so a significant increase. But then also, let's consider, according to the Office for National Statistics, they did a survey in late August, early September this year, 2023, and reported that 51% of adults in Great Britain reported an increase in their cost of living compared to the previous month. So that's a big increase. Then we've got September 2023. The Resolution Foundation projected that real incomes that were to have fallen in 2022, 23, and then will stagnate in 23, 24, which would mean a combined 2-year fall in the sort of the real household income of around 4%. Low-income households are most affected by rising prices, and the ONS data shows that households with the lowest incomes experience a higher than average inflation rate, while the highest income households experienced a lower than average inflation. And this, they said that the disparity is due to low-income households being more affected by high food and energy prices. So, and then, I mean, I'm sure everybody's read about the use of food banks. So food bank charities are reporting an increase in demand. The Trussell Trust reported that in the year to March 23, they provided nearly 3 million emergency food parcels, which is a record number, more than during the pandemic and more than double the number in the same period 5 years before. I mean, I heard people on the news talking about, as for example, teachers were saying they were having to use food banks. So we've definitely seen an increase there. We've then got obviously the mortgage disaster for a lot of people with 800,000 fixed rate mortgages ending in the second half of this year. I think that was an average increase of £220 a month. And then disabled people also spending a larger proportion of their total spending on food and energy. So they're disproportionately affected by recent rises in the cost of living. And my final stat for you is the Citizens Advice. God, get my teeth around that one, reported that in August 2023, they helped over 40,000 people with debt advice compared to 35,000 in August 2022. There's another debt advice charity, Step Change. I think it's called Step Change. And they had around 16,000 debt advice clients in June 2023, which was an 11% increase on the year before. Cost of living increase was the most common reason for debt, with 26% of clients citing this reason compared to 18% in June 2022. So, you know, the outcome of all those lovely numbers and stats is that obviously it's a massive crunch and impacting quite a large part of the population, with some groups being impacted more than others.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of how this is affecting employees specifically, there was some really useful research commissioned by CIPD. Obviously, an organisation a lot of you will be familiar with. The research was undertaken by YouGov over the course of winter 2022-2023. By the way, if you're interested in those statistics that Adrienne was just running through, they all came from a parliamentary report, parliamentary research report that came out last month. So they are very much fresh statistics. They are all verifiable as well. And if anybody wants to have a look at the report, which relays those, then just drop me a line. In fact, what I'll probably do is put a link to it on LinkedIn some point today after the session. So if you don't follow us on there, feel free to look us both up. So in terms of this CIPD commissioned research, again, some of the data coming out of that is quite striking, predominantly around the inadequacy of pay. So the CIPD research found that the proportion of employees reporting that their pay was enough to support an acceptable standard of living without having to go into debt for food and bills has fallen from 76% down to 60%. So 60% of the people researched said that their pay wasn't adequate enough to give that acceptable standard of living, which is quite shocking. In terms of those employees being able to cope with a sudden financial emergency costing £300, the percentage has dropped from 63% to 49%. So again, only 49% of employees surveyed felt that they had the financial resources to be able to cope with a one-off emergency costing £300. And crucially as well, for kind of looking forwards into the longer term, those employees who thought that their pay was enough to help them save for retirement had declined from 47%, so let's call it almost half of those surveyed, down to 30%. So less than a third, if my maths is correct. So quite a significant drop there. Tied with that, the percentage of workers who said that their employer was doing enough to support their financial well-being had gone from 36% down to 31%, from just over a third down to just under a third over that same period. And what I found interesting as well is there's this disparity in terms of how male employees are reporting being affected versus female employees being affected. Female workers are reporting being in a much less positive situation than their male counterparts. And an example of that is 64% of men said their pay was enough to cope with a sudden financial emergency costing £300 without having to dip into savings. Only 56% of women could say the same thing. So quite a disparity there. 37% of male staff saying, well, yes, I think my pay is enough to help me to save for retirement, contrasted with only 23% of female workers reporting this as well. And then finally, when you have a look at the data for those who are earning £20,000 a year or less, only 39% of those said the pay was enough to support an acceptable standard of living. So just acceptable. Only 26% could report that their pay was enough to cope with a sudden financial emergency. So what's that? Three quarters say they can't. And only 15% could say that their pay was enough to help them save for retirement. Now, I'm just going to pause there because what I'd like to do is just run a poll for you that are joining us live today. I've just got a couple of questions around the cost of living. So if you could just take a moment to vote on these two things. Hopefully it's popped up on the screen in front of you. What we're looking at here is, first of all, have you noticed any impact on the cost of living crisis on your employees? Yes or no? Secondly, in the last 12 months, have you implemented any measures for your employees to address the increased cost of living? So I'm going to take a mouthful of tea while I let that poll run.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that. While you're slurping your tea, in terms of the impact on employees, one of the things that I've seen come through from clients is the impact of those who are not fit to work. So, you know, there are a lot of people that are probably not fit enough to work, but are not in a position where they can actually take the time off to recover that they need, because they're probably only getting SSP. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think that's something is like, I need to come back to work because I'm probably not fit enough. And, you know, that leaves the employer and the employee in a very difficult situation in terms of how you handle that, because obviously an employer has a duty of care to the employee. But the employee saying, I can't pay my bills, you know, and it's the perfect storm of potential liability, because, you know, if the employer says, well, you're not fit enough to work, therefore you're not to come to work, you should stay off sick. But, you know, then the employee says, well, I can't afford to live. It's a really tricky situation. And I'm seeing that coming through.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, I'm going to just close this poll off. I mean, interestingly, 80% of you pretty much have said that you have noticed an impact, 20% no impact, 60% of you have implemented some measures, but 40% of you haven't implemented any measures in respect of cost of living. So yeah, that's quite interesting. Just a little straw poll there. In terms of how we see the impact of all of this kind of as employment lawyers in our day-to-day practice, really it's quite wide ranging, and you know, we're starting to see the wider ramifications in things predominantly like stressed out employees, stressed and anxious workforce. I think I posted a couple of weeks ago on LinkedIn actually about are we a nation of burnt out employees, because, you know, we had that survey that really reported some very concerning statistics about the UK workforce, the health of the UK workforce predominantly, and how burnt out people feel. And you kind of think, well, surely there's an impact on the cost of living crisis currently in terms of exacerbating those sorts of issues. So we're seeing stressed and anxious workforce, and what that translates into day to day are things like disputes in the workplace, grievances that need resolving, right? They all have a tangible real cost in terms of the impact of having to sort that out from an HR perspective. We're seeing things like workers taking on more hours within their current employer, which obviously needs some careful management. Workers taking on more jobs as well, so being able to work for more than one employer. Union agitation for improved working conditions, and linked with that, tougher pay negotiations as well. I mean, maybe you negotiate your salaries on a one-to-one basis with employees if you don't have a recognised union within your organisation. Quite a few of our clients are unionised, or part of their workforce is unionised, and we've certainly been involved in the past few months in terms of pay negotiations that haven't been fruitful, have led to balloted industrial action, and the threat of industrial action, the very real threat of industrial action, and all of that entails. Delayed retirement as well. We are an aging population. There's always this dialogue and conversation about how do we provide opportunities for people entering the workforce, freeing up positions, you know, having that career progression and path through. But delayed retirement, you know, I've had questions recently, I haven't had for a long time, around people who want to give back word in terms of serving retirement notifications to their employer as a means of actually sticking around, delaying the time that they're going to be coming out of the workforce. Which in turn has a knock-on effect in terms of succession planning, career planning, giving that pathway up. As I said before, we're going to be covering quite a lot of these in standalone webinars. So certainly we're looking at pay negotiations, trade union recognition, stressed employees, and the aging workforce issues as well. For today, though, we did want to talk to you about some of the strategies that we've seen utilised at the moment. So, Adrienne, I know you've got some thoughts on this point.
Yeah, I've got, well, I mean, a couple of things that we've seen. You've mentioned already about workers taking on more jobs. Now, probably most of you have got in your contracts of employment a clause which says, you know, you devote all your time and attention to our company and you can't take on a second job without our consent. Some of our clients have actually relaxed their rules on this to allow employees, like recognizing that, you know, particularly at the lower end of the pay scale, where employees are being forced to take on a second job, and they, you know, they've come to their employer and said, "This is what I need to do." So there's been a relaxing of that. And I've sort of we were sort of talking earlier about the pros and cons of each of these strategies. So the pros for that, obviously, is it gives the employees much more freedom to have control over their working life and their variable income, which is, you know, it helps to retain the loyalty of the employees, and also that obviously they're going to be better off. However, it's not without difficulty because, you know, as the employer, it's still your duty to look after their health and well-being, as we were talking about. And that's a big issue here. So you've got then fatigue and then how to monitor working time. All of that becomes an issue. But, you know, that's certainly one of the things that we've seen. And that might be where a company can't necessarily offer any more overtime or more hours, or the rates of pay can't go up and the employees have gone, "I've got no choice, but to go and get a second job." And so certainly we've seen that coming through.
Yeah, and I think, you know, your point about health and well-being being an issue there, and from a slightly more academic perspective, I suppose, as well, dare I say the words working time regulations. But, you know, monitoring working time, obviously the working time regulation stuff is all health and safety dictated, isn't it? It's seen as a protection measure to ensure that employees are getting adequate rest breaks between shifts or between days of work as well, that they're taking sufficient annual leave to recover from work. And that can be a bit tricky where you've got somebody working for multiple employers, and it's very difficult for you as an employer to keep track of whether somebody's working 70, 80 hours a week, you know, without you knowing.
And I think it's the without you knowing piece that's important, because, you know, in discussions I've had with some clients, it's like, you know, do we say yes to this? And the answer has to be, well, what's your choice? Because the employee is coming to you and saying, "I know I need to get your consent." So, you know, good on them for asking. If you say no, they're probably going to go and do it anyway. And then how do you monitor the working time? At least if you say yes, you can put in some controls in place. Whether or not they work, and, you know, dealing with an employee who is overtired and, you know, then coming to do work for you is an issue. I mean, I guess in the situations that I've had, it's very much sort of shift-based stuff where people won't necessarily be working 5 days a week, Monday to Friday, in that traditional sense. So it's just making sure that they do have those rest breaks. I mean, I think the discussions I've had is, you know, do you talk to your employee about what type of work? So if they're working Monday to Friday, standard working hours, but they're proposing then to take a nighttime job, then that is fraught with difficulty because there isn't then an adequate rest break overnight, and you run the risk of the employees then, you know, putting themselves in danger depending on their job, or just, you know, worth, you know, best case scenario, just not performing as well as they should do because they're knackered. So it is really tricky, but, you know, the alternative is you end up losing employees because they have no choice but to go find another job somewhere else that pays better. So that's another impact of losing a sort of established skill base.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, if anybody wants to jump in, we're not going to open microphones up or anything like that. But if you want to just send us a comment, you can do it anonymously, I think, using the Q&A or chat. And I think you may not have the option, but everyone will see your comment. But if you want to give any feedback in terms of initiatives that your place of work might have been using, or things that you're interested in exploring, what you've seen work well, what you haven't seen work so well, then I'm sure all the other attendees would appreciate the benefit of that knowledge. One that I was going to mention, it's obviously quite a binary blunt tool, but that is just pay increases. I think it's fair to say that lots of our clients in the past 12 to 18 months have agreed quite substantial pay increases to help their employees with the cost of living. I say primarily with the cost of living, but also I think there is a squeeze on talent at the moment as well, you know. So it's all about how do you attract and retain the best people, given the massive inherent cost of having to backfill roles. Obviously, one big plus for that pay increase approach, throwing money literally at a problem, is you get to retain the people that you want to retain. Bearing in mind, you've got to approach this stuff in a structured way, so you're not exposing yourself to risks of any equal pay claims, which can often arise out of kind of poorly managed pay structures. Let me put it that way. But you get to retain your talent. Now, we all know what an investment it is to onboard new starters. Keeping that experience within your business is really, really valuable. Andrew Bailey's governor of Bank of England probably won't thank us for advocating pay increases, because I think he was in the media earlier in the year saying basically employers try and resist the temptation to pay more because it contributes to spiraling inflationary measures. And, you know, one big con of this approach is it will impact on the profitability of the business. Certainly, if baseline costs increase and you're able or unable to pass that increased cost on to your customers, then it's going to mean a reduced profit margin. Bearing in mind, of course, that all of these increases in terms of cost of living and these inflationary pressures mean the cost of doing business is more expensive as well, right? You know, businesses are not immune to the costs of having to buy stuff. You know, the cost of energy, cost of raw materials, aside from employment costs increasing as well. So it can become a vicious cycle. We recognize businesses obviously only have finite financial resources too. We haven't seen, and I am a little bit surprised, because I've kind of been waiting maybe for the last couple of years for larger scale layoffs. Kind of thought it was coming, I guess maybe because of just the weird way that the COVID pandemic kind of ended. And I mean, personally, I don't know about you, Adrian, but I was kind of thinking, well, when's the point where everything catches up again and we're going to see these big layoffs? And it hasn't really happened. Thankfully, it hasn't happened. But I know that we have seen various maybe smaller scale restructures where there's been trimming. I don't know.
Yeah, I was just going to say that exactly. So it's more like sort of looking at I think you just said trimming, and I think that's a really good word. It's looking at efficiencies, but it's not sort of like a massive swathe. Perhaps an increase on certain smaller functions being outsourced as well is something that's been seen. But
outsourcing or not backfilling roles when people have been, so pay increases for people who are sticking around, people who are going, not being backfilled. But of course, it still means that the work needs to be done. Maybe there can be efficiencies, that wonderful word that's used a lot to drive change. But efficiencies might work. But, you know, those who get the pay rises might find they have to work a little bit harder, perhaps, as a result. What about flexibility as a theme?
Yeah, I think flexibility continues to be sort of like the real buzzword. Obviously, we moved from the pandemic through to hybrid working, and most people are a massive fan of that. But if you can't, I suppose, in terms of the cost of living crisis, if you're not in a position where you can increase people's pay, and I have read quite a lot of stuff in terms of, you know, increasing people's pay does not necessarily give the benefit that's needed. And I know that sounds somewhat wrong, but increased pay means increased tax, increased national insurance, and, you know, all those types of things. So the benefit isn't as great as it should be. So this is where the flexibility comes in. So, you know, we've had this, say, the hybrid working. There was the 4-day week pilot that ran, but and a lot of companies that took part in that confirmed it was a success, and quite a lot continued. So, you know, the flexibility piece, which is encouraging, is that actually it helps people save on their own personal costs, which is one way of making their pay go further. So, you know, they can cut down on their travel expenses, car parking charges even, and even sort of childcare arrangements. So, you know, you think about the cost of a season ticket for a full week going into central London, for example, to take it at its best. I mean, that's a massive chunk of income that goes out. And if there's hybrid working, then that's quite attractive to be able to save on that. I know on the hybrid working, companies did report That it bought a lot of loyalty, and you know, those people that were not allowed to work remotely for at least some of the week were looking elsewhere for jobs. So, you know, there's sort of a bit of a double win there. But yeah, in terms of working with your employees to help reduce their personal costs, that's been quite a big thing. What are the cons of that? Well, everybody knows that managing a hybrid workforce is not easy, and certainly presents a challenge for managers.
Back to work, please.
Yeah, let's go around and put post-it notes on people's desks saying, I expect to see you here. Yeah, and it isn't easy. And I think actually there is a bit of a change, isn't there? A lot of companies are now ramping up the return to the office. For perfectly decent business reasons, I'm sure. But in terms of what we're talking about today and helping employees ride out this cost of living crisis, that's the hybrid working has been something that's been quite attractive.
Yeah, it's a different way to approach it. And actually, you might find that it has an impact on to headline business costs as well. I can think of several companies I know that have given up office space and either worked to a model where they will take on a temporary basis space to bring teams together, or they have just completely done away with the office and moved to an entirely hybrid, entirely home working method of working. Obviously, that's not going to be for everyone. And for some organizations, it's completely impossible to achieve anyway. I mean, certainly if you're in the manufacturing sector, for example, or some type of retail service industry, then yeah, you're not going to be opening shops from people's bedrooms. But otherwise, there is scope there for a bit of creative thinking. Obviously, the interest at the moment is, the wind. How did I describe it? I think the pendulum is maybe swinging back again, and a lot of the noise in the media is about bosses saying, "Come on, we need people to be present in an office a little bit more." Whether that's actually reflective of most businesses, I'm not so sure yet. I kind of hold back judgment on that, I think. But yeah, the next few months in terms of how that shakes out is going to be quite interesting, I think. So in terms of other things, other practical things that we've seen happening, obviously the age-old employee benefits thing. And I'd be interested to see some stats on employee benefits in terms of how much they're actually utilised. And there's, you know, there's loads out there. There's loads of providers out there that can help with this. So gym memberships, providing lunch at work, for example, fruit bowls at work, salary sacrifice schemes for different things like cycling, which obviously I'm going to be a big champion of. So massive cycling fan, but also the health benefits that are associated with that, the cost savings that are associated with it. They're all things that could be utilized, and you might already offer those sorts of things as well, but there might be an engagement piece in terms of the uptake of those and people. I mean, I know from just things that I might have access to otherwise more generally, and probably not always making the most of these things. You know, when you sort of think about, well, through your mobile phone provider, you can get a free coffee at a certain place once a week, or free cinema tickets, or there's just probably loads of things that could be utilized that aren't being utilized that will help. Has multiple advantages, of course. It kind of positions you as a more attractive employer as well.
I'm just going to chop in there because there's some really interesting I call them flexible benefits, but there's providers out there which have a whole raft of this stuff, which I find really interesting, and it hands the choice to the employees who can pick the benefits. So they might get given a headline cost that they can spend on what benefits they choose. And I'm not talking about the traditional ones of you can go for private medical insurance for your family. I'm talking about a whole load of lifestyle choices that people can use that benefit allowance for, and people really starting to think outside the box in terms of what's on offer. And I think that actually works quite well for a lot of employees, because as I say, it's handing them the choice. So I think that's quite an interesting move, because you're basically, again, it's cutting down the personal cost. So instead of increasing pay, it's like, well, we can't increase the pay because that impacts that, but let's look at the benefit allowance that we provide people and give employees more choice over what they choose to spend that on. And so that's a way of reducing those personal costs.
Yeah, and I know, you know, we've obviously talked about this data in terms of people who are earning £20,000 a year or less. But when you look into how, you know, the entire workforce cross salary multiples are affected, middle earners which is classed as 20,000 to 39,000. So, you know, £39,000 is not an insignificant salary. It's more than the, I think, median average salary. Middle earners have reported, you know, one of the highest rates of being affected by the cost of living crisis. So some of these schemes may appeal to middle earners in terms of, you know, salary sacrifice schemes, for example. Something else I read about, which I thought was fantastic, is so a recycling waste management company, Suez, they came up with this idea of payroll auto saving, based around a philosophy of save before you get paid. And it's just basically encouraging staff to build up a rainy day fund, kind of almost without noticing a direct impact on take-home pay. So, you know, harking back to that statistic about how many people have the resources to be able to cover a £300 financial emergency, Suez have, you know, identified a need to help their employees build up a rainy day pot of money. So there are initiatives like that. I think also just taking the stigma out of talking about money problems and maybe introducing some forms of financial education as well. Again, it's not going to be free to buy in these services, but I think the engagement that you can get with your employees from running something like that would probably be massive. There are definitely third-party providers out there that will come in and run financial education programs. Now, that can tie in with your benefits and reward strategies as well. Again, referring to what we're just talking about in terms of benefits and utilization of some of the benefits that you've got in place. But just some basic financial education might be really, really valuable to some people. But I think the fact of having that discussion just to take away some of the stigma around problems associated with money as well could be really helpful. I think in terms of this awareness point, Adrienne, obviously, you know, everybody that's attending today has an interest in this area, and there's some value in having an awareness of the issue, right, and these factors.
Yeah, absolutely. And because we all know that anything that's going on in your employees' personal lives is bound to spill over into the workplace. And so sort of having an empathetic view to start with to find out what's going on is probably going to be the precursor to any discussions on performance, for example. You know, we've seen it, you know, for a long time about personal reasons, you know, family breakdowns, etc., all of that kind of stuff which impacts. Well, this is exactly the same. So it's a question of finding out what's going on with the employee first to see what support can be offered.
Yeah, absolutely. As I said at the start, this is just an introduction in terms of what this series is going to be covering off. So we're definitely going to be doing a deeper dive into some of these key themes over the coming weeks. Our next session is going to be in 2 weeks' time. So 2 weeks today, same time, 11 o'clock. For those of you that are new to our webinar series, please do check out our past recordings. If you want to have a listen on Spotify, we've probably got 20 to 30 episodes recorded on there now, covering all sorts of different employment and business immigration related matters. So thank you very much for attending today. We're always open to feedback for new sessions, so please do get in touch. If you'd like to drop us a line, give us some feedback on the session. Otherwise, we very much look forward to welcoming you in a couple of weeks' time. So enjoy the rest of your days, and thank you.